Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Welcome to the fourth edition of Bright Lights, Green Sights. My name is Samth Kadakia, and I am joined today by Frederick Hudson and Priscilla Bala. Frederick is the founder of Pigeonly, a technology company that builds low-cost communications products for people who have loved ones in prison. Priscilla is an alum of the School of Management and is currently the Director of Mentor Relations at the Yale Entrepreneurial Institute. Welcome to both of you.
Frederick, it's such a pleasure being here with you today. First heard about your story, as I mentioned, on NPR, and I've been so inspired ever since by everything that you've accomplished. And I think it's a really amazing tale of not just leadership, but also of overcoming odds in a way that can inspire lots of people around the globe to be doing the same. So let's talk a little bit about that. Can you just do a brief recap of your story for those that might not be familiar with it yet?
Sure. So I founded a company called Pigeonly, and we build low-cost communication tools for people who have loved ones in prison. So our two flagship products right now is a photo printing product, which allows people to easily send printed photos from their cell phone, tablet, or computer. And then we have a voice over IP product that allows people to save money on expensive prison phone calls. I started the company out of my own personal experience. I did close to 5 years in federal prison for distribution of marijuana. And it was during that time I noticed that there was this large population of people that no one's paying attention to that all shared the same problem. They had a desire to communicate, and the barriers, whether it be the cost of barriers or the process barriers, were just really, really high. So we set out to build a company to leverage technology to address those barriers.
That's fantastic. And I mean, I think it's really neat to see how your personal experience motivated you to really go after solving this problem also. So let's talk a bit about that, sort of going from the tradition of being, hey, this is not working right, to I'm going to be the one to fix it. How did that happen?
Yeah, I think for me, it was just, I just knew it had to be a better way. I know we hear that all the time. So, you know, that's usually where the idea comes from. And it was just out of my own personal frustration. It was a frustration that I shared with numerous other people. And, you know, that thought of, you know, there just has to be a better way. I also had the motivation of knowing when I was going to be released from prison, I didn't want to have to rely on somebody else to give me an opportunity. So I much rather be in a position where I can create my own opportunity. So I had those motivating factors, and this was a problem that was authentic to me. It's something that I understood well. I understood the market. I understood the user base. I understood the pain points. So it was just a natural fit. And I also saw that, you know, technology was at the point where this could be easily solved. It's just that no one had really took the time or effort to really focus on this particular use case or this demographic in particular.
No, absolutely. Well, and now that you talk about it, it seems obvious to a lot of people in hindsight, but it can have been easy as you were going through it. So could we talk a bit about some of the challenges and what motivated you to keep going and how you overcame them?
Yeah, some of the challenges I think any entrepreneur would face is, you know, the initial, you know, transitioning from the idea phase where you have a good idea and then you want to transform that into something more tangible, something more real. Mm-hmm. And it's just that learning curve. I mean, there's, you know, regardless of how much information is out there, there's really no step-by-step playbook on how to build X or how to create Y. So you really have to really kind of learn while doing. And quickly figure out the things that are working so you can focus more energy on that and then rule out the things that aren't. And it's just a series of doing that over and over and over again that allows you to build a company. So for us, you know, those were the challenges. The challenge was at first, you know, how are we going to be able to get a prototype or get the first version of product built, even though, you know, we didn't have a lot of resources, even though myself and my co-founder did not have a computer science background or know how to program. How are we going to be able to hustle and get something built so that we can at least get something in the marketplace so we can start getting some real feedback from customers to know, you know, how close to the mark are we or not? So those are some of the most challenging areas. And then once you overcome that, then the big challenge is, okay, now that I have this thing working, how do I make something work for more people, or how do I scale this idea up, which has its own set of challenges? You know, something that worked well for, you know, a couple hundred people is completely different for a couple thousand. So it's really just those nuances that you really only learn by just trial and error and doing things and trying what works and scrapping what doesn't.
No, fantastic. So let's talk a little bit about those steps, because that's quite the journey, right? Going from having no product to having a prototype that people are going to give you feedback on, and then later building a company and scaling that company. So how did you do that first product? I mean, you just told me that you and your co-founder didn't have those technical skills. And I know there's a lot of people out there that are in the same shoes. So how did you do it?
Yeah, I think the first thing is to not be intimidated by not having a background in the technology industry. So, the first thing that we did was we just posted on Freelancer and said, hey, this is what we're trying to build. And we saw a bunch of people that just started bidding on it. And that's how we was able to get the first product built. And it was rough. It wasn't beautiful. It didn't work well. You know, it broke quite often, but it was enough to do our core value proposition. I think when you can focus on the minimum viable product that you can build, or MVP, building that MVP will allow you to really focus on what are the core features that your assumptions that you can use to validate your assumptions of whatever product or service that you're building. For us was that the assumption was people want an easy way to send photos from their cell phone, tablet, computer. So really what our MVP needed to do was it needed to be able to upload photos, and it needed to be able to have those photos printed so they can be shipped. So we really focused and honed in around that, even though it was clunky, even though it wasn't the first version wasn't that great. It did that one part very well. And that allowed us to get early feedback early on, and so that we can have something to build on, which also allows you to communicate for future or potential employees to join the team, because they can see that you have something in the market that's working. It also allows you to take it a step further and raise funds, so investors can see that you actually had the ability to build and bring your concept and make it real. And that you have actual users on it. You know, those are probably the most critical things that you can show to either build your team or to bring in investment capital.
Yeah, so that's great, because it's a perfect segue to my next question, which was going to be, you know, once you built it and you got all this feedback from folks, now you had to actually turn it into a company.
Right.
And that requires a fair bit of capital. So let's talk a little bit about that process and how did you do that?
Yeah. So when we first started, we had our MVP built, and we had our first initial product built, and we were starting to get customers. And then I happened to come across this CNN special was Black in America talking about Silicon Valley. So this was my first time I was exposed to, this environment, or this ecosystem, if you will, where people are building products and things like that. So when I watched the show, I learned what a technology accelerator was. So then incubator. And I started then doing research online and just started applying to every incubator I could find, because previously we were struggling to help to get the local community, because we was in Tampa, Florida at the time, understand and wrap their brain around what we were building. So what they were used to is investing in real estate, or they were used to doing other types of business investment, not necessarily technology type investments, where, you know, there's not an hard asset, or, you know, you're building something that's intangible when software, and it's not necessarily a house that I can put a lien against or something like that. So the investment community in Tampa didn't really understand. So when I started applying all these accelerators, of course, you know, we got turned down at pretty much all of them except one. The one accelerator I did accept was called the NUMMI Accelerator, and it was an accelerator that focused on primarily underrepresented groups of people for technology. So women, African-Americans, et cetera. We went through this program, and then at the end of the program, we were able to raise our first seed round of $1 million. And then we leveraged that seed round to build the initial team and then build upon what we already had when we joined the accelerator, which was our first version of the product. And then we were able to build traction and then go on to raise future capital. To date, we've raised a little over $5 million. And we have a team of 25 people.
That's great.
That all started, you know, way back then.
That's fantastic. So before we continue then on the journey of growth, I also want to follow up on this point that you just made about the underrepresented minorities, right? Mm-hmm. When you think about entrepreneurship these days, it's the idea that comes to mind is generally a much more homogeneous group that's heavily male, heavily white, and heavily sort of upper middle class.
Right.
How can we change that? What are your thoughts on increasing diversity so that we can harnessed all of the energy that entrepreneurs of all colors and backgrounds have?
Yeah, I think the first step is for people on an individual level to just really, when they're thinking about what they want to do as far as business or business ideas, entrepreneurship, just really look around them. It really starts at home. What I mean by that is when you focus and you build a product, you know, that reflects a problem that you understand, you're going to have a lot of, you're going to have a naturally diverse ecosystem, because my upbringing and my background is going to expose me to things that someone else's upbringing and a different background is going to expose them to other things. So where it may be authentic for one person to build an Uber, it's going to be authentic to somebody else to build an app that's going to make it more efficient to go to the barbershop. So I think as people just really look around them and build things that address problems that they experience directly or indirectly in their social networks, I think that, you know, we're naturally going to start seeing more people coming in industry with diverse backgrounds, building diverse things that reflect those backgrounds. That's one side of it. The other side of it is for the investment community. The investment community is going to have to be deliberate at overcoming that natural bias that they will have when, you know, they're going to have people come in their office that don't look like the typical person they invest in. So, you know, if you're a betting person and every time you place a bet, you've always placed the same type of bet on the same type of person, hoping to win, hoping to have the next Facebook or the next big thing, you're naturally going to want to continue making that bet. What's the reality, though, is that it's also a huge benefit to bet on people that are doing different things, because they're going to have a unique or diverse view or diverse approach to solve a problem that may open up an investment community or investor to opportunities that they never would have been able to have in their portfolio.
Oh, that's a great point. And so when we think about any other barriers that those groups might face, or that folks that think about entrepreneurship and they might want to make a step into it, but something holds them back, you know, how can we inspire them, or how can we encourage them to really move forward and to give it a try?
Yeah, I think it's one of those things you just have to get in. The water feels great. You know, you just have to jump in. So, you know, there's really no set way to start. There's really no set way to do it. There's a number of paths you can take to build something great. And it's really one of those things where you just have to start, and don't allow yourself to buy into the narrative that because of what you lack, you don't start something, or because of what you don't know, because of what you don't have. Like the number one thing that someone may tell themselves, which actually isn't true, is, oh, well, I need to get funding before I can start. Or another one is, oh, I can't do this because, you know, I don't know how to program or code. Like those things may be factual, but they're not necessarily true as a true barrier to actually start a company. So those things are not required. So the biggest thing is to, you know, identify a real problem that you can build a solution to, and then validate that assumption. Is this something that people actually want? Is this something that actually people need? And try to do that as low tech as possible without writing one line of code if you can help it. There's so many tools online now where you can actually get MVPs off the ground without doing a lot of work and without spending a lot of money. So everything from using prototyping websites where you can design your site and click through it without writing any code, to the number of platforms that exist that you can quickly validate or test an idea. You know, leverage those things. I mean, it's easier now than it's ever been to actually build something and see if you can get traction, see is this something that people are willing to pay for or not.
Great. And then once you get that traction, now the real challenge begins, right, which is growing that thing.
Right, exactly.
So let's talk about this next step. I mean, it's so inspiring to see the courage that it took you and the perseverance that you had in building this and bringing it to where it is. But now you have a number of new challenges on your plate too. Right. Hiring a team, managing all these people. Let's talk a little bit about those challenges as well.
Yeah, those are one of those things where, you know, I'm learning as I go through it now. And when you first starting, the first thing you can think about, one of the things you think about all the time is, you know, as soon as I get money in the bank, you know, I'm going to hire all these people and I'm going to be able to build this. I'm going to be able to do that. And then once you get that, it just comes with a whole bunch of things that you didn't consider. So, you know, it's one thing to have, you know, X number of people, but it's a whole nother thing to manage X number of people, which requires different skill sets. So one of the simple things that we're seeing, even with, you know, in our size, we're only at like 25 folks, but even at our small size, just communication alone breaks down to have 25 people on the same page, working on the same mission for the same goal. And it breaks down. So, you know, one of the things we're learning and we're having to focus on is, you know, how do we improve our communication between departments? How do we keep everyone on the same goal? How do we prevent breakdown or you know, one group, you know, didn't quite know this or didn't quite know that and another group did. So it's really important to put that, you know, be able to put those procedures and structures in place to be able to help the company move as one giant organism versus independently. So those are some of the learning curves that come with growing. And then so you have that culture, and then you have the same thing on, you have to do the same thing with your customers. So, you know, how do you go from, you know, when you only had, you know, 1,000 customers, you know, it's easy to deal with all the support tickets and phone calls or questions or all those things in a relatively short period of time. But how do you do that when you have 200,000 people? Like, what, how do you maintain the same level of value that you want to give your customer as your thing, as your product or service starts to scale? And which also usually requires going back to and rethinking your technical architecture, which goes back to rethinking how you, decisions that you made early on and how you would do things. Does it properly reflect, you know, what the organization looks like today and what it will be tomorrow? And a lot of times, in our case in particular, we've had to revisit a lot of things to make things more efficient. We've probably have redone the back end, just the technical side of the back end of our site, probably 3 times already, adjusting for scale and adjusting for new things that we didn't consider before we started scaling. So things like that, you have to be open to, and you can't, one of the biggest things I've learned is that you can't ever have your heels in the ground on a decision that you made in the past. You always have to be flexible and willing to adjust based on the new information that you get every day.
Yeah. Well, and that even impacts sort of the direction of your company for the future also, to your point, right? As you scale, the challenges are different, but even your vision for it might change somewhat. You started with a product that was going to solve this one problem, but now you have a passion for really helping these people on a number of different way. Right. So tell me a little bit more about that. How has the evolution of even the purpose of what you're doing driven you to now think about these other issues as well?
Yeah. So when we started, you know, the problem we was addressing, we was working to solve, what we want our product to solve, was we just wanted to make it simple to be able to send a photo to someone in prison. That then grew into what we have today, where the core of our business, or 80% of our business, is around the data that we're collecting and organizing. So we spend a lot of resources collecting and organizing the millions of records that exist that basically allow us to be the only nationwide inmate lookup that exists. Mm-hmm. So what that means is we're able to identify and locate people in different institutions across the U.S. in real time. That allows our photos, when a user is uploading and sending photos, that allows them when they select, you know, they search for John Smith, they find John Smith. It makes sure, is ensured, that data ensures that those photos are delivered to the right place. In another use case with our phone service, when someone searches for John Smith again, they say, hey, you know, I want to receive low-cost phone calls from John Smith. The same data of us knowing where John is, what institution he is, the rules and regulations of the institution, allows us to generate a telephone number that would work well for John Smith, so that when he calls you, he can call that number versus your existing line, to be able to save the most money possible when calling home. So now that, you know, with data being such a big part of our offering and such a big part of our business, it's allowed us to really see the bigger picture, where we're finding that the folks that have a loved one in prison also have other problems in common. Those commons extend from housing to searching for employment to very basic having a bank account. There's about 30% of our user base that's underbanked. So what we're seeing is that although we started with inmate services allowed us to grow and create a market that or acquire a market that has a number of other issues that we can build products and leverage technology to build solutions for. One of those things that we're interested in is in the financial sector. So helping people get banked, helping people with find employment, helping people with housing, in particular, the 7.5 million or so people that are recently released, helping them identify, you know, where's the place I can go get a job and how do I get my first cell phone? How do I do all these things that a returning citizen needs as brand new consumers, but do not have that that brand or company that they trust or to get this information. Everyone, you know, even from medical services, you know, how do I get set up with medical services or things like that? So it's a host of number of things that we've actually, you know, as a company has just saw that, you know, our real goal is to really make poverty less expensive and how we can affect that and how we can leverage technology to really build tools and products that, you know, allow us to meet that mission.
That's amazing. And can you elaborate a bit on that point? I mean, that's such a powerful idea, right? This notion of making poverty less expensive. What is the reality? What is it that a lot of people don't know about when it comes to how the how poor people might, in some cases, have to pay more for services?
Yeah, in general, it's generally that statement is true. So most people, you know, low income tend to pay more for things. So they tend to pay more even to pay a bill. So, for example, a low income person will go pay a bill. They'll go to their local check cashing place or they'll go to their grocery store and they'll pay a bill and they'll pay a $4 to $5 convenience fee to pay that bill. A low income person may not have a regular bank account. So for them to actually use a debit card for something that they can only pay online, they have to pay also a $4 or $5 convenience fee. So you have these business models that I don't think was intentionally set up to be predatory, but it ends up basically making things more expensive for the people who actually have the least amount and to begin with. So, for example, someone who doesn't have a bank, not only do they have to use a prepaid debit card, but they have to pay every time they get paid to cash their check. So for most people who have bank accounts, it's they have direct deposit. They can't even fathom having to pay a fee to get your paycheck cashed every week or whatever schedule you are for getting your paychecks. Even when it gets to traveling and most people, you know, they're given money for using credit cards. You get reward points. You get all sorts of things versus someone who is paying above a higher amount just to use or have access to credit. So, you know, those are the things that we're seeing that, you know, those are areas where I think technology can leverage and level the playing field because a lot of these industries and a lot of things are set up are archaic in a way. They've been set up and been doing business like this for a very long time. And I think technology is a perfect vehicle to be able to disrupt a lot of those industries.
Great. And how does that disruption really take place then? Because as you're mentioning, if business as is has been or has, you know, for better or worse, or intentionally or not, had this predatory attitude before, how does one now build credibility with those populations? Or how do you build trust so that they know that you are there to help them or to provide them with a better product at a better price?
Yeah, I mean, I think for our approach to that was, you know, we started with a very focused position. And that focus was, we're going to start with MA services. We're going to make it easy for the 16 to 20 million people in this country who know someone or have someone close to them that's actually currently in prison, be able to communicate with them at a low cost. And we're going to go above and beyond to create the best user experience we can create. And we're going to bring a level of quality to this market that has never been seen. So we've pioneered a lot of things in that regard where simple things that we take for granted, like, you know, you sign up for a web service and you get a free trial. That's something that's, you know, unheard of in the institution market. Not only do you don't get a free trial, but for something that you may pay $1.50 for a candy bar in prison, that's $3 to $5 for that same candy bar. So not only are they not used to this level of someone bringing this level of business, this quality of business, this quality of operation to them, they are typically pay more for general things that, you know, people don't pay more for. So that was the first step, is really building credibility and building trust just with our own products and services. So now that you do trust me when, you know, you use our products and service, whether it be for the phone calls or whether it be to send photos When I offer you a debit card, or if I offer you another product, you'll also trust me with that as well. And that was the idea, and that was the goal, to build trust and then be able to expand and build upon that trust with other products.
And so what's next now?
So for right now, our main focus is really just to nail down all the different means of communication. So right now we have photos and phone. So we're going to expand upon that, allow for people to be able to also do postcards and greeting cards, and then messaging, which is big. And then after that, we really want to dig our teeth in into the financial side. So disrupting the process of people sending money to the loved ones in prison, and then also for people transacting that are outside of the financial system because they don't have access to credit or debit cards.
That's phenomenal. So any last words of inspiration that we should leave our listeners with today?
I would say I always encourage people, you know, the big great idea is really going to be found very, very close to home. It's something that you've experienced. It's something that people that you care about have experienced. And it's just you just saying, you know, every time you've had that moment, well, why does it have to be like this? Or I wish it was a better way, or this is annoying, or this is inconvenient. Those are all the seeds to building a very big business, and not only a big business, but something that can be impactful. Because when you build a product around solving a problem, you're really going to be making a real difference in people's lives, and it's going to be easy to be able to basically focus on your impact and also building a business at the same time. Like, they're not mutually exclusive. You can do both.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Frederick. It's such a pleasure having you here today.
Thank you.
At
thank
Yale.
You.
And I hope that your story will continue to inspire many, and that your journey is nowhere near complete.
Thank you.